Thank you to all the poets. One of the keynotes of this evening is gratitude, and we extend gratitude to you. Our thought this evening was not to disperse quite yet. We in the past have handled Poetry Matters events in different ways, and one thought that we had for this one was inspired by an event earlier this year that Lisa and I attended. So maybe could you unfold a little bit about what you had in mind?
Great. Yeah. So sometimes we have done Q&As in the past, and we are hoping to do that this evening. Mm-hmm. But at the Sarah Ahmed Lecture, which was sponsored by the Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies, as well as
this
other
fall,
institutes this past fall at McGill, Sarah Ahmed Institute of Practice, which for me was very reminiscent of Eve Tuck's Indigenous Feminist Approach to Academic Q&As, wherein rather than immediately launching into checking, you know, like sort of asking people questions, we would ask that you first engage with your neighbor. You know, sort of chat for like maybe five, seven minutes. Take a few minutes, sort of unpack what your thoughts are. And maybe from that, try and formulate questions. And we would ask that you make sure that you are actually asking a question. yes. So check in with your neighbor. Is this actually a question? Think of it as a very chill peer review. Yes. So with that in mind, just sort of chat with your neighbor about things that you might want to ask our three poets.
And one thing that occurred to us also when we were talking about this was the possibility of just providing a word that came to mind in response to some of what you heard, because sometimes
that's all you can
coalesce
reach for
that way.
So just have at it.
And please feel free to get some tea and coffee upstairs.
Yeah. So let's sort of have a brief break, check in with your neighbor, and then we can sort of reconvene. Yeah. So I suppose, what questions arose for you during this reading? And I will sort of facilitate, so throw my hand up. Mike.
Question for Rebecca. So you mentioned secular magic. I just wonder if you could speak more about that. It sounds interesting.
Yeah. I think what I mean by secular magic is ritual practices that don't have a particular dogma behind them. I've been kind of dabbling in mostly traditions that have like either very ambiguous or very syncretic, like drawn from everywhere practices, things like tarot and horoscopes, that don't really have like a particular doctrine. So they're adaptable and kind of fluid in a way that I really like, because they transfer well to poetry, that they're mostly associative and intuitive. That's kind of what I mean by that.
Just as a follow-up to that, I found really radiant and magical your mention of magic during the reading. And I wondered what came to mind for each of you when you thought of that magic in connection with the poetry that you just relayed, your creative process recently. You know, what comes to mind about what kind of magic was happening or is happening? Because I found really powerful that you mentioned that.
Yeah. Is that directed at
any of you?
Okay.
See what happens in the moment as you think about it. What kind of magic has there been?
Music.
Yeah?
Yeah, music is a very much part of the process. And it feels quite magical when you're in the music.
It's compositional, like when you're working on a poem and you're struggling over a word or a phrase or a line or whatever image, and then all of a sudden it happens and the poem trickles in front of you and you complete it. And that happens. It can happen over the course of an hour, a day, weeks, or whatever, but it's always, I guess the fact that I can't predict it makes it magical.
It's interesting, because when I think about magic, I think about something that I can't access because of how I was brought up, because also you were talking about your grandfather being a healer, and it makes me think of shamanism and all of these things in other countries, which is more prominent and more part of maybe not everyday life, but tradition. And I wish that this magic would kind of be part of me, but I feel like I would be forcing it almost to kind of try to bring it into my life. That's something I could have felt a little bit too. One of the reasons I'm really interested in stuff like, well, tarot is like the easy example because like no one really knows where it originated, or it seems to have various roots depending who you ask. Because a lot of like, I'm gonna say white magic practices tend to be really appropriative of like traditions from other cultures in ways that are commodifying and otherwise violent and colonial. So things that have sort of this like ambiguous origin and are adaptable to anyone who wants to pick them up, and it basically depends on you to like form what the backbone is of it and what you want to guide you. Yeah, and it is partly because I also kind of feel divorced from like my grandfather's whatever he was practicing. I don't know that tradition, and it wasn't passed on, partly because of immigration and various other things. So yeah, trying to like find a magic that you can kind of create is what I'm going towards, I think.
I do actually have a question in response to that a little bit. Say magic that you can create, which I totally get. We've talked about this. I mean, I've known, full disclosure, I've known Rebecca for years. So yeah, we've had these conversations. Can magic, when you are creating it, and this is also just a general question, you know, sort of compositionally or musically or sort of, yeah, a non-Western tradition, let's say. Because I think white magic is a different thing. Anyways. Can magic, the magic that you're creating, can that also sort of subsequently create healing? Is healing a thing that can be created? Is gratitude a thing that can be created? Sort of thinking in our overarching theme, I suppose, for the season, is wellness a thing that can be created?
And I think Christian mentioned that gratitude felt like that which you could command, that which you could control.
No more than happy.
And that's not even necessarily for the poets in the room. I mean, I know there are more than three poets in the room. Hi. Lovely to meet you. But I suppose, as a group, can we create these things? What would it look like if we did?
And I do really like the concept of gratitude as a choice, because I always think of magic in terms of faith, religious faith for some reason, and because I think of it in terms of faith, I see it as something that's not really accessible to me, kind of like what you said. Because I was never raised in faith, like I was raised as an atheist, I feel like if I think about getting religious, it would be appropriating someone else's religion. But gratitude, when I feel gratitude, is the only time really when I feel like I'm getting close to something like religious faith. Because I rarely feel like there's the presence of a god somewhere. When I feel sad, I don't feel like I can like complain about my life to someone. But when I feel grateful for what I have, that's the only time really where I feel like there's someone, something, or somewhere that gratitude can go. Like, I feel like that's a directed movement, if that makes sense. And that's really something unique to gratitude. I don't get that for any other feeling.
Thank you so much, Hannah. That's fantastic. Anyone else? I like the idea of gratitude as moving.
Yeah.
As going somewhere.
Baha. I want to shift the subject, go to a question of writing and ask the poets about their habits of writing. I want to know how the poem comes to them, or if they go to the poetry, I don't know. Is it an idea when it comes to your mind? Is it an image? Is it a word? Is it a sentence? How do you work it out?
Piggybacking off that, I was also thinking it would be interesting if we talk about the interrelationship between spontaneity and inspiration in regards to this magical process. When it confronts you, but also things, you're creating a circumstance in which that can arise, you know?
Or is such a thing, does such a thing exist at all? Tell us, please.
Please tell us.
Oh, how a poem, oh, so for me it's, okay, yeah. A poem for me begins in a, something that breaks my normal flow of things. Something stands out at me and calls out, yeah, calls out, says it's significant. And I then, before even really evaluating it, I just get it down on paper. It's often a word, a phrase, often something in the day, but often when I'm reading, too, something stands out. I like something really luminous, yeah, transformative on the page, so I write it down. I let it sit there, and if I come back to it, I still feel something, but then there's something there, and I'll work from there.
So it's not an event or something, it's more what you read.
It's I read and I'm inspired by the reading, but it's all, everything. It's a way of like being in the world.
I feel bad because like the process can start in any way. Like sometimes I could be reading something and that'll start me thinking something else I want to write. It could be. Sometimes I'm just writing fragments of things that I'm thinking and I can string them together, and once they've had like a gestation period, they can be woven together in a way that makes sense. To talk about the spontaneity, like it's just the process can be spontaneous in a way that there's definitely like a way of thinking similar to what Mike was saying, but the way it starts and Yeah, like the magic you were talking about. Like you never know exactly how it's going to be or how long it's going to take. The poem can take, like Rachel Blighty Plessy wrote a 114-part poem over the course of her life in 7 books, and that's one poem. So it takes, yeah. Which isn't a satisfying answer.
I mean, I'm just aware as you're talking that you, to some extent, have been working together as poets,
yeah,
right? And so, it's interesting to think about how you coordinate.
That's a concrete way to answer that.
Yeah, so how we coordinate ways of writing, which can't always be easy.
I was fortunate to meet Christian last year before moving back to Vancouver, and right just when we both really liked Phyllis Webb, so there was an immediate connection, and we decided we'd collaborate. I live in Vancouver now, and he's from Vancouver, but lives in Montreal now, so we've been working on poetry, just shooting stuff back together, and appreciating the sort of the magic, I guess, that happens when you read someone else's work and somehow have to respond to it or write in the wake of it. Yeah, there's a magic to that too.
Yeah, it's quite an incredible process to not be talking about what we were doing, not be commenting on like, oh, is this what you meant in this, and just responding with another fragment afterwards.
Oh, this will tell you.
Yeah, so it was a call and response.
You just write more poetry.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was...
And then after, once we compiled enough, we did sit down and it's like, oh, is this what you meant? And like, oh, I completely interpreted you in this direction. So it's, that was really cool. I think collaboration is a bit of magic as well.
I don't really have a solid answer for my conversation. You mentioned working from fragments and stringing them together after they've kind of like fermented for a while, which is definitely something I do. This is why I don't write fiction. I don't have like an attention span for plot, or like coherence in a given moment in my writing style. I don't know. I feel like I have to wait for enough fragments to happen and then just lay them out. Sometimes like physically print them out and like lay them out on the floor and start like shuffling them until something kind of crashes together and has to happen. I feel like a lot of what I'm trying to write starts out as bad jokes about things that I can't express. So like a lot of puns that I like put in my phone notes or notebooks and then I try to build from later. It is kind of like a practice of learning how to make accidents happen in the right way, whatever the right way means. And that is never really certain.
Would you elaborate on putting those things on the floor?
Yeah, partly it's a product of not having time because I'm in a PhD program, and also having like mental illnesses that mean that I have terrible memory and trouble thinking in like linear fashion at all. So I do write a lot of just fragments. Sometimes it's literally just like a word, or sometimes it's a paragraph of mush that then I have to physically like lay out on the floor and look at all at once, until I start to see patterns emerging, things that might need to go together. So yeah, literally shuffling papers around is how I make poems happen sometimes.
Now, one of you commented on the way that the non-linear seemed like an opening of a process. I can't remember who said that.
Was it?
Yeah, it was Christian. Yeah.
Because
you associated that with Phyllis Webb at one point.
Yeah.
But that was what inspired you.
Non-linearity for Phyllis Webb means that everything is a process, so there's no end or beginning. So it's just, yeah. So you're always writing, I guess, is my answer. Never writing, because you're, I guess, experiencing and learning.
Were there any other questions?
Or other directions, I suppose.
Or
the
directions,
things you wanted to raise.
Yes,
hi.
I have a question. When did you start to write for feeling?
Sorry, could you speak up, please?
I wasn't asking. At what age did you start writing poems?
I'm not sure. I think my first poem, I had an answer for that. It was like 9, I think. And then, when did I start really seriously writing? I guess during my undergrad. No, not that long ago. Only 19. Yeah. In a literature program, to start writing sonnets,
I was 18, and my first poem was about missing a bus. It was just as unremarkable. Yeah, that's about all I can say about that. It's terrible. Yeah, but 19, 20, I was starting to take it seriously.
Why did missing a bus make you write a poem?
I don't know. Break the flow.
I find it really interesting.
I don't know.
Missing
dates.
Missing
places.
That was something
in life,
so.
Yeah.
I wrote a lot of bus
poetry. Yeah. I spent a lot of time on buses when I was in university, so that was a lot of my time. I think I would have been.
All those bus.
I forget how old I would have been when I started trying to write poetry, but I was. I don't feel like I started doing it seriously for myself and like in a way that felt honest until very recently, like last 5-6 years maybe. Partly because I think for a long time the way I was taught poetry, I knew I liked something about it, but I thought it had to be a certain way, aka look like sonnets, and also appeal to a certain mentality, which I then realized was just like I was trained to write and read for dead white men, which I had to like unlearn, and I still sometimes like find myself falling back into, and like it's hard to break out of that voice and that like feeling of what poetry should be and then find your own version of that, so I feel like I'm kind of still figuring that out. So pick any number and age.
Anna, did you have a response?
I have a question, like, piggybacking on that, because I just listened to you guys read your poems out loud, so I don't know how they look on the page. So, like, do you work with specific format or not? Because that's something I've always wondered about when writing my own poetry. Like, all the stuff I write, I just basically throw it up, and then I'm like, I don't know what to call it. Well, I guess it's poetry then. But I think poetry deserves better than that. So call it that. Like, since you're not writing for dead white men, like, do you use reverse or like?
Mostly, yeah. I will like dabble with forms here and there. but I usually break a lot of rules. I've been thinking a lot about form in part of that, like, unlearning process, because I got used to writing with line breaks in mind and basically writing long columns with, like, evenly divided stanzas with similar line numbers per stanza or that sort of thing. And more recently, I'm kind of playing more with gaps in the page. I can show you one after.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But I'm thinking about where, like, what the visual space on the page means now. And that's really interesting, especially when I'm writing about things like memory gaps and trauma responses and stuff like that. So it feels really useful to think more about form.
And the gap becomes a unit of form.
Yeah.
And do you feel that affects your performance at all? Like, do you ever find that, like, playing with a form, like, on the page, like, opens up, like, new ways of, like, performing the story?
I'm still, like, figuring out what the transference is between, like, the gap on the page and the gap in spoken performance. But it definitely makes me think a lot more about how poems sound and where breaths need to be and why. Yeah, I don't know if either of you two have particular forms you work in.
My poems are quite sprawling all over the page, which makes a lot of them not viable candidates to be read to groups. They're meant to be seen. I worry sometimes about big gaps, because sometimes I want to take a lot more rests than I do, because I'm worried that people will think the poem's over. But I agree, I think gaps are a huge part of the form. I think rhythm also is something that really ties my poetry together, much more than, like, meter.
You said rest rather than gap, so you're thinking musically.
Yeah.
Rhythm, yeah. Mike, I happen to know that occasionally you think about breath in poetry. Through, for example, Olson.
Yeah.
And does it come into your own work?
Not this time. I actually put Olson aside for this one. Charles Olson, the guy behind Projective Verse, the whole manifesto. Poetry should be starting from the breath and the unit. The line unit should be somehow unique to how you breathe and how you speak. In this case, I just wanted it to be readable. This was a story, and I wanted to be transparent, the story to be transparent. I didn't want to draw too much attention to the how the story was told. I was much more concerned with that. So I put Olson aside deliberately.
Yeah.
It's a great, great question.
Intentionally. Yeah.
Yeah, but often Olson, those sort of things are in mind. Yeah.
Nora, Sam, and then Bahar.
I love what you said about the gaps in the page, kind of having a connection, though not maybe not a one-to-one connection with sort of memory gaps and things like that. So, question for all of you: does the form that you use, and I think mostly free verse, does that somehow lend itself to the content that you guys are writing about, sort of grief as like an unformed thing, and so does that lend itself? And I guess if you are writing about happiness or gratitude, does that change the form or not necessarily?
Great question. So much of writing is just kind of making the map as you go along, right? So if you're trying to answer questions around deep grief, just going through there, asking those questions is getting you closer to something. And with happiness, I get the sense that you're happy and you know why you're happy, so you write about it. So in some ways, it's predetermined, happiness. But getting out of grief, writing towards it, I don't know. It seems more amenable to, like, free verse, which is just a little more exploratory. Yeah. As I see it.
That relation in my stuff. I know, like, each poem feels like it needs a different form, and I have to kind of let it take over in some ways. I'm trying to think of, I can't remember the phrasing exactly, but Carmen Maria Machado's In the Dream House, it's a memoir about trauma and abusive relationships, and the way that she writes about it is very concerned with form, and there's a part where she talks about realizing that during a really difficult time in her life, she was like struggling with why she couldn't write coherent or linear plots, and why things were so speculative and horrific and going into very strange forms, like writing a novella about Law and Order SVU, where she rewrote every episode. And she talks about writing that and only realizing much later that she could only think through forms that didn't make sense because her brain wasn't making sense.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah, and I think a lot about that particular, like, I've heard people use the, like, hermit crabs as a metaphor, in that, like, they will make a home, like, instead of a shell, if they can't find a shell, they will find a piece of plastic or a can or, like, something that fits that they can live in for a while. And I feel like poetic forms kind of function in that way, and that you kind of just stumble across whatever needs to fit in that moment, even if it's not appropriate. And then it is somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, towards these formal concerns, I was hoping to reflect upon like the politics of psychicality within the poems that you read for us tonight and how that kind of works within your process.
Yeah, that definitely is something I've been thinking of, because I realized that a lot of my poems are taking on, like, not footnotes, but like I quote from other sources so much that I feel like I need to be clear about where that's coming from. It's some of it's like academic texts or other poets, and other stuff is literally words that I've, like, phrases I've overheard in coffee shops, or one poem I have has a couple sentences that were spoken by my cousin's 4-year-old about drawing someone without a face, which is just like, I feel like it's partly because I'm trying to, I don't know, I feel like my poetry tries to, like, expand beyond myself, and I feel like that I need to include other voices in that sometimes, or there are just things that I can't bring myself to say that others can, so I feel like citation in that way kind of enables not just a conversation with those people, but also allows you to say things that you can't. Yeah.
Sources a lot. The book that's coming out, Mike read it like almost a year ago and told me, because I had a bibliography in it, he told me to drop it because it was just too, it looked way too academic. Yeah, I have a response to what you said, because I also feel like needing to include other voices. But that doesn't get me out of myself. That brings me like more into myself, because it's my perception of other voices. And so that's, I use that to understand myself through poetry, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of always both, I think. Because it's words that you need that you can't quite find in yourself necessarily. But also it's a way of like inviting participation. Yeah.
And acknowledging like gratitude for a word or a phrase or something that felt meaningful in that moment, someone acknowledging it.
Yeah.
And it can come in really strange forms too. I'm thinking of, like when you said an academic bibliography, I recently had to figure out how to cite a meme, which is really fun because you don't. Well, memes are ephemeral, and the MLA doesn't know what to do with
that. The MLA doesn't know what to do with a lot of things.
Fair.
I actually taught memes yesterday. This is examples of rhetoric in class. I was telling Rebecca about this earlier. Fantastic. Bahar?
Yeah.
You had a question?
Yeah. So I won. Okay, it's not good. It's too much.
It's
not good. It's good.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you.
So I'm asked about
the importance of accessibility to meaning. How do you care if people understand how it makes you change the form, makes it easier to give the clues, to have the footnote? Do you do the footnotes because you, do you feel it like an ethical urge, or you do it because you want to clarify the thing you are thinking about?
I didn't have any footnotes in this case. Men are accessible. Just to be take it really direct, someone finds that compelling too, and then they can go to the source, right? So there's that passing on of knowledge, sharing of knowledge, which is what you find significant. In terms of accessibility and ethical, yeah, so in some cases I feel like, yeah, this is so significant, I have to acknowledge this in the acknowledgments of a book or a chapbook or whatever, or after the title. So there's no hard and fast rule for it.
I was thinking about what you said earlier, though, about trying to make this poem plainer than others. Maybe that doesn't accord with you, with accessibility for you quite, but you did this poem differently than you've done others.
Yes.
Sort of
yes.
Backgrounding some of the language and even some of the form that you've
used
before.
Accessibility.
Was that toward accessibility of a kind?
That wasn't the motive. It was,
okay,
I want someone to get this story, but I guess that's another way of saying it.
Yeah, you want people to get it.
Yeah, get it, and I just didn't want the form to be obtrusive, so.
Yeah.
So I guess that aesthetic decision was informed by accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
I find it, just for transparency of the process, to know that these were the things I was thinking about, these are the pathways. In terms of like accessibility of meaning, I think my goal is to give enough clarity that a reader can know what I'm thinking, but it's not so much that it gets in the way of their own interpretation of whatever sticks up to them if they're liking the poem or not liking the poem. It's a careful balance of clarity, I think, so that it doesn't end with what the poet wrote and intended. It opens up what you're reading.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about accessibility while trying to kind of figure out how to share, like, because my poetry background and my writing life has mostly developed in academia, I kind of struggle with the weird elitism of that and various aspects of it, but I really want to find a way to make that knowledge shareable with people who don't have access to academia as well. And I know that's coming through in how I'm processing thought in poems, so I have thought a lot recently about why I use certain kinds of language or metaphor, and yeah, it's definitely something that I'm still in the process of thinking about, but I found too that really thinking about who I'm writing for and why they need it is what's guiding me through that. In that I know that certain poems have, I use different voices or registers depending on who I feel like I need to write to. And often it's like quite a selfish thing, as in, am I writing to myself right now? Like, do I need to write this poem because of where I am now, or because of where I was when I was 8 years old? So at times I want to write for someone who needs that, like, whatever version of me or someone else needs that at whatever age or stage of accessibility they need. It gets a little complicated because then I'm, like, imagining various, like, imaginary readers. Often it's asking myself who it's for. That's what guides the accessibility. Because if it's an angry poem about academia, then I will use high academic language if I need to, and throw it right back at the place that I don't love necessarily, or do love and want to criticize. But if it's a poem for, like, with a lot of the poems I write about mental illness or sexual assaults. I'm writing for other survivors who need it, and I want them to get it, even if they what they get from it is something different than what I would get. Yeah. Hope that answers.
Something that occurs to me in response to what you're saying about accessibility and access is what you said about bringing readers out of hell spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Something that you, I guess, talked with somebody about you said.
Yeah, it was from an episode of the podcast called Can't Lit. I forget what number or title the episode had, but it was with Jay Simpson and another writer whose name I can't recall right now. It might have been Jessica Scott. Correct me if the name's wrong, but that idea of being responsible to your readers.
Because if you're bringing them in, then you're responsible for bringing them in.
So two questions, and like one that just like struck my mind in response to that is, like, first of all, like in that tension between like academic writing and creative or poetic writing, do you ever feel like the influence going like the other way? Like, does your like practice as a creative writer, do you feel like it affects your prose, your style, or your like thinking in academic writing? And then like the follow up question to that, like, something that just like comes to mind in follow up to like Miranda's question is that I feel that sort of like attentiveness to like the needs of the reader are like much less present in mind in a lot of academic writing, right? Like, you wouldn't really ask in academic writing, oh, make sure to bring the reader out of there, right? There's a lot less of a sense of like the journey that you're taking, or there's less sort of like attentiveness to the journey that you're taking our readers through as an academic. And I was just thinking of like, if that's something that you ever like thought about.
Yeah. I think I mostly encountered the idea of accessibility in writing through the creative writing side, but mostly because I was encountering like disability writing and disability justice activists, which are kind of writing in a space that is both kind of academic sometimes and also not, and often a grassroots movement. And like, I think I've carried that definitely into my academic work more than the other way around, even though the boundaries are very blurred. Because I think a lot of academic spaces, not all of them, and there are quite a few spaces that are moving very progressively around this, are starting to, well, a lot of academia traditionally does not care for the reader, like you said. And it does exclude people based on their privilege and their ability and their background, which I think is something that a lot of academia needs to contend with. Very few fields are doing that, some are. But a lot of that work has been done more on the creative writing side. A lot of people who talk about this are spoken word writers, and performers who perform for activist movements and marginalized groups who don't get access to things like academia most of the time. So I always think about how to dismantle the bad things in academia by bringing in stuff that either comes from it or from other areas. I hope that answers your question. It's rambly.
Yeah, I actually break in on that?
Yeah.
Okay. Because as an academic writer, I absolutely think about my reader. I am cognizant of the story I am telling my reader.
Mm-hmm.
I try to think of it as, like, when I am stuck, and I tell my students this, I ask myself, what story am I trying to tell? Whose story am I trying to tell? What do I want my reader to know? And what am I hoping to evoke in my reader? I mean, yes, of course, the Academy has a lot of problems and we dismantle them, but I mean, I think that it's also crucial to remember that we are also writers.
Yeah.
We are also doing that work, and it is not magic, it is craft.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it is important that we recognize how much overlap there is between the work that you and I are doing and the work that people who we consider to be more sort of inherently creative do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important that we don't sell ourselves short.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I know, and I mean, I didn't mean it in a way that I think that, like, academic writing inherently is, like...
Okay.
But I was saying how, like... because I also, like, when I write, think of it as a sort of, like, eminently creative and in storytelling sort of, like, adventures of, like, ideas, like, whatever. But the thing is, like, it's never, like... It's never thought to you that way, like, or
There's a lot you have to unlearn.
There's a, you know, because at one point one of you was talking about having to undo habits and patterns, and so it's sort of it's a set of received patterns that we have to move in actively and
I think much like Christian sort of turning to the sonnet when he started to write poetry. Similarly, if you're first starting out sort of in academic prose, you turn to
the three-point essay.
Yeah, you turn to the three-point essay, you turn to the five-paragraph essay, and then you slowly begin to unlearn that. You slowly learn sort of what stories work for you, what ticks in your writing fit, and they may change, they may grow, they may develop. So, okay. But yeah, no, I hear you. Yeah, it's sort of, there's a received knowledge. It's, I mean, not to, like, be rude to Derrida, but...
Please be rude to Derrida.
I'm not going to do that. I'm surrounded by a bunch of people I work with. Christian.
Has anyone read Rachel Vladimir-Plessy? Because she completely
blurs
the line between academic and creative work.
I study HD. I read Rachel Vladimir-Plessy.
So I really recommend New Guitar.
Yeah.
There's another one with the word pink in it, which is also very good.
It also be Pink Guitar.
Oh, Pink Guitar.
The Pink Guitar.
Blue something.
Yeah. Lisa and I were actually exchanging the other day about a form or a mode that one could try, and it was, for me, it was inspired not by Rachel Vladimir-Plessy, but by Kristeva, by Julia Kristeva. And I was remembering an essay of hers from a long time ago, Stabat Mater, that involved two different columns of writing, one of which felt more formal, if you want, a bit more academic, and the other of which was much more free-form, free-flowing, and it was meditations on actually childbirth. Yeah.
Yeah, and a sort of a kind of contemporary iteration of this, like The Argonauts, where she has citational bit, and it's still quite academic and still theoretical, but it sort of has, you sort of get lost in it as well. So.
Yeah, but it's both at the same time juxtaposed.
Yeah.
I find that I was going to Kristeva too, and that was what did it for me, was reading that exact essay, Stabat Mater, where she's writing half in memoir, half in academic, half in poetry, and realizing that you could do all of those things at once was really revolutionary to me, because I was taught that they were different things and you had to separate them, and people who do stuff like Kristeva, like Vladimir-Plessy, like Maggie Nelson, and even I'm thinking too of Billy Ray Belcour is doing this a lot, who's writing kind of evens the ground and takes everything on the same level, like all kinds of knowledge are valid, is what comes out of that as a philosophy, I think, and that's what's really important about any kind of writing, really, and I think that the academic writing that does that is so revolutionary for those reasons, because it cares for the reader and it validates all kinds of wisdom beyond what's traditionally held up and put on a tower or a pedestal. And similarly, a lot of the poetry that's doing similar things in terms of validating different forms of knowledge, I think, is what, it feels the most urgent and ethical in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and you wrote that division between, or like false division between academic and creative writing. Like, in my experience, I just find that the academic writing that I've read, like the most efficient ones, that were those that incorporated a creative element, where like it sort of felt like a blurred line between both writings. I think that really speaks to the point of, I don't remember who said that, like, critical work is a kind of creative work on its own, and should be considered as something, a genre in itself, not just something that's just referential to other works. But, like, I wonder if it says anything that I don't think the same way of creative work. Like, I don't think, the more academic it is, like, the better it is. Right? Mm-hmm. It's a one-way relationship.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Does it feel kind of like unidirectional?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
I mean, not to like insult on academic
writing. Oh God, no, and I don't think anyone's doing that.
There's
honestly,
space for that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is space for that. Although this is recorded, this feels a little risky. Sorry.
Straying a bit, I had a question about like artistic identity, and kind of like, especially in these sorts of events, do you find that you kind of have who you are as a person and then who you are as a poet? Like, does there seem to be like sort of a separation? And then in like on that, like in the context of these kind of readings, like when you're selecting the poems that you're going to be reading, are you thinking about what kind of identity you're shaping for the people who are listening?
I really hate when spaces like these are inauthentic and when it feels like I'm just shaking hands and getting to know people because I ought to know them because it's the literary world and that's what you do. So I don't feel like I'm putting on a mask or an outfit except for in those like self-promotional moments where I just feel like I hate this. This isn't why I do this. But no, I feel like my life and the writing are very, very like complete overlap a lot of the time. I mean, I have a tattoo of the chickadee. That was the last poem I read. Like it's completely overlapped. Except for that like side where you have to put yourself out there, and that feels inauthentic because authentically I would not just introduce myself to a random person that doesn't necessarily feel immediately like me, but you also, it does. I think the way I reconcile that is that you can write the best poetry ever, but if no one's reading it, then I mean, it matters to you, but if you want others to read it, like, you're not going to know it's the best poetry ever unless you're putting yourself in those spaces and meeting people.
The poetic self and the self, I don't know, the other self, they're pretty similar. But riffing on what Christian's saying, it's a pretty private self. I'm not one to network. I'm not one to get up on and present in any loud manner. Really, really like being quiet in the world. It's kind of just a shyness. So it's reflected in my poetry, I think, the themes I explore and sort of meditative mode I like to think I'm writing. And yeah, that's the self, who I am too. So yeah. It's a great question.
I do feel like I've had to think about self-protection a little bit, in that a lot of my writing is trauma-based. And I don't necessarily want people to come up and ask me after, like, oh, who did that poem refer to? It was really abusive. Like, and this has happened before. So I do take a lot of care when I'm selecting poems that I'm reading ones where I feel like I will feel safe in the space. And I always, like, I did this today. I bring a few poems that I'm like, maybe this one, but depending how it feels, like, I will or won't read one of them. And I did actually end up reading the ones that felt like most risky today, and skipped some of the less risky ones because this felt like a good spot for it, and like thanks to the whole crowd for all that. But yeah, I feel like at the same time, it's like there are so many things I can't just opt out of being that just I have to be a queer brown femme with trauma history in real life, and it doesn't. I don't get to take that off in poetry, so I just have to choose very carefully how sheltered I'm going to keep myself on that level. And yeah, letting poems that fictionalize more or that kind of diverge from the really vulnerable stuff depends on, yeah, the venue and how accessible the venue is in terms of, like, having active listeners around. And I do think about, like, how do I pick what to share based on the audience and, like, caring for the audience as well in that sense. Because I won't read something that's really graphic if it's a completely, like, support-free space. Because that would just feel irresponsible and kind of cruel. Yeah. So I definitely try to be as caring as possible to myself and others in performance.
We do have time for one more question, if there's any other questions. Yes.
Yeah, I have had a question for you. You're talking about inspiration and sort of breaking the flow. Do you find yourself searching for those breaks in the flow, or is it very important that it stays organic? Or does that change a lot with the subject matter that you're trying to write for? Whether maybe for a more environmentalist sort of thing, maybe that organic nature would come out better in the writing, per se.
That's a great question. Generally speaking, I think it's a more like a receptiveness, a way of walking through the world. And being open to things, because you can close down and be, I don't know, unidirectional, or we've been talking to linear. You can treat a day as a linear thing and just explore, or not explore and just go through it. But when it comes to, I don't know, writing about an environmental poem, I think I would be more attuned to some, a new development in climate change or something like that. Or in my case, it's pipeline politics in the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Some development in that, that would contribute to the meanings of the poem or something like that. So in that case, being organic, open to that sort of organicism. Yeah.
Cool.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's
yeah.
No problem.
Cool.
Okay. All right. If
there's nothing else, then please join me in thanking our readers.
Well, thank you all.
And thank you all.